Randy Mosher joins me this week to discuss brewing fruity IPAs. This is Beersmith Podcast number 218.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 218, and it's July 2020. Randy Mosher joins me this week to discuss creating the fruity IPAs. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller with exact precision and flexibility. The Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and amazing advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. I've just released Beersmith 3.1 desktop update, which includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, and a whole lot more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Randy Mosher. Randy is the author of Mastering Homebrew, Radical Brewing, and Tasting Beer. He's also a partner in two breweries near Chicago, Five Rabbit and Forbidden Root. Randy, it's great to have you back on the show. How you doing, man?
Great to be here, Brad. Hanging in, you know, just holed up in my little basement workshop here and working on projects, working on a book.
You were mentioning a minute ago you had a new book in the works, not necessarily about beer, I guess, this time, huh?
It is not a beer book, but if you're a beer, if you're interested in, if you're a beer taster or want to be a beer taster or you care about tasting about anything, it should be a really useful book. It's about 2/3 about how it works and 1/3 about how to do it better.
You forgot to mention the topic, though.
Yes, tasting.
Tasting.
So it's really kind of a science journalism book diving into the particulars of the science behind our chemical senses and how they work for us.
So kind of maybe an adjunct to the tasting beer book you did a couple of years back?
Yeah, I mean, it's designed for a much wider audience. One is just people who are kind of science and psychology interested, but others who are, maybe want to know a little bit more about the food they eat or the beer they drink or the wine they love. And, this should help understand how we're put together and what kind of techniques are used to get the most out of the tasting process.
And you mentioned there's a lot of interesting research going on in this field now.
It's unbelievable. You know, it turns out we have taste buds in our noses that function as a kind of a rapid response to bacteria that they can, one of the sets of taste buds is for bitterness, and they can sense the bitter compounds that bacteria use to signal each other with and squirt out nitric oxide, which is toxic. So so people who are so-called super tasters who have a higher sensitivity to certain types of bitterness, they generally have fewer respiratory infections because their system is a little more robust.
That's very interesting. So it's almost antibacterial there, huh?
Totally. It is absolutely antibacterial. Yeah. And it just happens like that without any involvement of the immune system or the brain or anything. It's just at a cellular level. Pretty fascinating.
Sounds like a really nice project. I wanted to ask you too, how are your two breweries doing? You got two breweries near Chicago that you're involved in, your partners in.
Yeah. We're back open. Our Forbidden Root is a full on brew pub chef driven, type of menu. So we've been open for carry out, since we never closed. But we've been hanging in there doing, you know, with a very small staff, doing some, you know, what we're pretty proud of in terms of the overall volume of business. The neighborhood's been very supportive. Five Rabbit is more a production brewery out in the suburbs, but we do have a really large tap room, and we're just we just had opened it up for outdoor seating, and they're getting ready to drop one more level down to open up for inside. So we're hoping we can bring some of that business back, because that's been a big source of revenue for us out there. So we're surviving so far. That's you know, the best you can hope for these days. So we'll see what happens in the next few months.
Well, that's good. I've been encouraging people to try and support breweries that are struggling right now. Obviously, a lot of breweries struggling right now. So
yeah, and if you're buying beer, you know, try and buy it directly from the brewery, because first of all, it's going to be fresher and better. So you should do that anyway. But breweries make three or four times as much beer if you buy it from them rather than buying it from retailers.
Three or four times as much money, I think you meant, right?
Yeah, three or four times as much revenue, because they're getting all. They're getting the wholesale markup and the retail markup, and you know, so doesn't cost you anymore, but the breweries make a lot more money on it. So.
Yeah. Well, today you want to discuss using fruits and spices in an IPA. What are some of the challenges you run into when doing that? I would imagine IPAs are probably one of the harder ones to put fruit in, right? Harder
they styles. They are a little bit, because IPA is such a well-defined style in itself. You can only put so much fruit in it before it starts to turn into something else. And so you have to work within that style window. The good news is that hops contain a lot of chemicals that hops contain a lot of chemicals that are shared by a lot of different fruits, especially things like citrus. So a lot of esters, a lot of you know, other types of chemicals, like think about linalool and geraniol and beta citronellol. Those are the very, very common compounds in hops, and they also are common in things like coriander and lavender and all different kinds of citrus and some other fruits. And so you really have an advantage to kind of work with the hop chemistry. And it's good to dig in a little bit to understand what is the chemistry, and then you can kind of match up your fruits to make that work a little better for you.
Well, why don't we dive into a little bit of the hop chemistry? I know in recent times we've spent a lot of time talking about how to get fruity flavors and aromas into beer, primarily by using hops. Sure. Can you talk a little bit about that approach?
Yeah, well. So a lot of the recent developments in hops have been breeding for more desirable hop aromas as the market sees it. So if you think about a Cascade, and all the sea hops, basically, that's kind of West Coast pale ale and IPA sort of flavor. Mm-hmm. They're high in a compound called geraniol. Mm-hmm. And geraniol, as you might think, is a chemical. It's a part of that family. It's called a terpene or a terpenoid. And it has a strong rose or geranium type of aroma aspect. I think of it myself as a very pungent floral that if you like smell a marigold or something like that, that has this like sharp. It's floral, but it's very sharp and a little pungent. And that for me kind of sums up maybe part of what people think of as dank in those types of hops. And so there are other terpenoids like linalool and citronellol that are a little bit more towards the citrusy. And it follows the evolution of pale ale in a way, or IPA, that we went from these sea hops, and we found some hops that were a little more citrusy. Think about like Citra hops, for example. Yeah. And so we went away from that kind of dank West Coasty thing, and now we started bringing in a little bit more of the citrus things. And that was maybe, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, we started really seeing those hops come to the fore. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, since then, you know, right about that time, the New Zealand hops kind of burst onto the scene and bringing more tropical kind of notes, a little bit of mango or guava or passion fruit and those kinds of things. And so those were, you know, those started to become popular. And then at the same time, American breeders and breeders in Slovenia and Germany started working on hops that also had more fruity characteristics. It was interesting. I went to the craft brew conference last year, I think it was, and we were talking to an English woman whose family has been in the hop business for a long time, and they showcased a hop at that convention booth that was really fruity and just like smelled amazing. And we were really eager to get our hands on it. And she said, "Yeah, we discovered this plant in our kind of breeding program about, I think it was maybe 20 years ago, and they liked it, but they couldn't find any use for it in the brewing world at the time. But they kept it going. They kept a few plants going in their little archive garden. And then, of course, in the last few years, when that sort of hop flavor became really highly desirable, then they started scaling it up and growing it a little bit more. So it's interesting, you know, how much of that market is driven by what consumer demand is.
Yeah, I mean, craft brewing obviously has totally changed the hop market. Back in the 70s, they were making all these high alpha hops, right?
Yeah, I mean, that started in the 1800s even, breeding for alpha, because people were just basically using hops for bitterness and really not much more. And all those wonderful New Zealand hops, that breeding program was started, I think, in the late 50s or early 60s. And they had developed a bunch of really unusual hops, and they were kind of scratching their heads about what to do about them. And sometime much more recently, they put those out to brewers in Australia or New Zealand to make some special beers and just kind of get like, hey, what do you guys think of these things? And it turned out that people just absolutely went nuts for them. Mm-hmm. And that was their first real clue that they had something really wonderful on their hands. And so Nelson Sylvain was one of those, and several of the others of those New Zealand hops, Motueka, I think. So that was really the beginning, but it wasn't until they had validated that by brewers and by consumers that they really thought they were onto something. So,
and we're just really starting to understand the underlying chemistry. I know you mentioned thiols play a really important role, linalool, geraniol, all those things kind of come into play, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the thiols, those are sulfur compounds. Mm-hmm. And the thing about sulfur is we are ultra sensitive to sulfur, because we have little nanoparticles in our aroma receptors, mm-hmm. that can nanoparticles of zinc. And zinc and sulfur, and also copper and sulfur, like, are hugely attracted to each other chemically. And they think that there's something going on with those zinc nanoparticles that helps make sulfur really strongly attracted to these receptors. And so I know that people at Barth in Germany, which is, I think they're the largest hop supplier on earth, or one of them anyway, they had to buy all new gas chromatograph equipment, which are the analytical equipment that's used to separate all the different aromatic compounds in anything. And because the sulfur compounds are an order of magnitude or more lower in terms of their threshold, which means you need it takes less and less of them to make a real impact on the flavor. And so the normal GCs that they were using just were not sufficiently sensitive to be able to really track these important chemicals. And of course, these are the same chemicals that you get, like that Sauvignon Blanc character that is sort of associated with passion fruit, with that kind of latex or rubber glovey kind of aroma that is very prominent in things like mango. So there's a number of them. You may see them. They're just normally identified by an acronym, and 3MMP.
3MMP is one of them, and then there's some 4Ms, and I can't remember all of them.
And they're all like methyl something, something thione, you know, they're very long chemical names, so it's just easier for everybody to abbreviate them. But that's been a real revolution. And of course, the plants always had that capability anyway, and it really just took breeders, well, it took demand, to, you know, some, but somewhere between breeders being curious and then finding something that's they thought was interesting, and then getting the consumers and brewers involved to see if maybe there was a opportunity to use them. So
I know the winemakers have been known about thiols for a long, long time. Sure. But on the beer side, you know, I think you're right. I think the chemistry is just starting to catch up, really. And thiols, I should mention, only really exist in U.S. hops and hops that have U.S. heritage, like the New Zealand, Australia, right?
You know, I'm not 100% sure about that.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
It may be, and you know, the all of those hops like Cascade and things are, a lot of that breeding began with European parentage, like a Sots or a Kent Golding or something like that, plus a wild hops. You know, there's a, there is a land race of, or a species, really, I think, of hops in the U.S. called Neomexicanus that is a component of that. So maybe that, I'm not all that much up on the history of the chemistry of the hops. So that sounds about right.
Well, in addition to the hop selection itself, you also have to, how you use the hops has been really important, and that whole technology has evolved as well. Can you talk a little bit about how you can take some of these breeds that have, you know, varieties that have a lot of linalool and so on, and actually use them effectively in the beer to get these fruity flavors?
Yeah, the process is something that they're calling biotransformation, and it's basically a chemical reshuffling or a rearrangement of certain molecules, like geraniol and linalool and beta-citronellol. They have a lot of common aspects of their molecules, and it's very easy for them to be slightly modified by yeast during fermentation. And so what you normally get is you start with a hop that has a high amount of geraniol in it, and that's sort of one of the least desirable of aroma characteristics these days, is that pungent geranium, floral, dank, West Coasty kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And if you put a round of dry hops directly into fermentation on the second day of ferment, like we normally will pitch the yeast, come in the next day, and add the hops. And what happens if you have active dry hopping during real active fermentation is you get some transformation and a change in character of the hops that goes from that sort of dank geraniol pungent floral character, and now it's starting to turn into, it goes from there, it goes to linalool. Now linalool is often described as having kind of an orangey characteristic, like, or maybe even like a Earl Grey tea, that fruit in Earl Grey tea, bergamot, or some kind of character like that. But it also has a coriander character, and coriander itself is, if they're making pure linalool, they'll normally start with coriander because it's like 50% coriander in the aromatic oil, or maybe higher. And it has that orangey, also a little bit of a lavender type character, because lavender is very high in coriander. So now we're getting into citrus, floral, like a nicer kind of floral, and then there's another transformation that can happen from linalool to beta-citronellol. Beta-citronellol is maybe a little bit like a lemongrass type of thing. So we're moving from a dark, sort of a earthy, orangey kind of characteristic, coriander a little, and then we're moving into a lemon character. It's a little brighter. And again, that's a little bit more desirable hop characteristic. Now, if you start with a hop like Cascade, you're not really going to get a super fruity characteristic because it doesn't have much of those thiols, and it doesn't really have a ton of citrusy kind of components. So you'll get a little shift. We like Mosaic is a pretty good hop to use with that, because Mosaic has a fair amount of geraniol in it, which is kind of its downside. So we don't like at Forbidden Root, we don't really like to dry hop with that hop later, but we'd like to use it early because it does have that geraniol, excuse me, that it does have that geraniol characteristic or geraniol component, and then that can be biotransformed into something more lovely. But then its other personality side is really that beautiful kind of tropical aspect that it presents. So that's Mosaic's a good hop to do that with.
And so, I mean, in many cases, you're using multiple hop additions here, right? I mean, you're perhaps using one during active fermentation for dry hopping and then another one later?
Yeah, typically for the New England hazy, juicy, whatever you want to call them, we do one dry hopping during active fermentation, and we do a second one on maybe on day five, day six, something like that. With the triple IPA, we come back a few days later and do one more at the end, just to give it a little kick. So,
and of course, you're using a lot of fairly large hop quantities here, right? And one of the things I've noticed, some of these, even some of the commercial examples, you know, some of them do develop these vegetal off flavors or whatever, I think, from maybe using too much hops. Have you seen that?
I haven't really too much. You know, it's certainly a possibility. Their hops contain chlorophyll and things like that. But yeah. I don't know. It hasn't been a problem for us. You know, you need to keep the mouthfeel up and keep, you know, just really work on the beer and make sure that the beer is the right beer to do that with. Those beers have to have a real creamy presentation, a lot of fat, mouthfeel, a little bit. A hint of sweetness is not a bad thing, especially in the stronger ones. The market seems to like that. You know, some people put lactose in them. That's not our favorite thing, but there is a market for that for sure.
Well, let's talk about fruit now itself. So you're going to use the hops perhaps to get some of these you know, fruity tropical flavors into the beer. But you also, in some cases, supplement that with actual fruit, right?
You absolutely can. I mean, the place to start, if you're just fooling around with it, when you kind of see where it goes, citrus peel is just amazing because you're basically boosting one of the characteristics that's already there in hops. And it doesn't take a lot of citrus peel. You know, for a batch of homebrew, you're talking about maybe one or two oranges is all you need to give it a really pronounced citrusy aroma. And fresh peel is generally the best way to go. You can buy dried, but I find it's, you know, citrus oils oxidize pretty rapidly. So they turn into something that resembles furniture polish sometimes when they get oxidized. So it's not the nicest characteristic. And fresh citrus is almost always available. And so
do you recommend using oranges or what? Lemons, limes?
Orange, grapefruit, lemon, lime. You know, really, I mean, it really depends on what the idea behind the beer is. You know, when I brew, whether, you know, it was I'm not brewing homebrew anymore, but I've got two breweries that I help with recipes sometimes. And we always like to make sure that we have the idea behind the beer first. Like, what is it we're trying to do? Are we trying to tell a story? Are we just showcasing some hop or some weird idea we had? Doesn't really matter, but you want to get that clear first. And then you work out, like, what is the flavor profile of this beer intended to be? And then you work backwards, you know, from what you're really on your label description almost, and try and achieve that. So really, you know, do you want something that's really grapefruity? You know, we made a gin and juice beer at Forbidden Root, and that had juniper and grains of paradise and grapefruit peel in it. And, you know, that was pretty fun beer. But you know, oranges are lovely and limes are lemons. And then there's other things like yuzu and bergamot and, you know, some more exotic things. Sometimes we've got a produce guy here in Chicago called Dave Odd, and he has a company called Odd Produce. And he one of the things he does in the winters is goes down to Florida and drives the back roads and looks for like derelict orchards and weird trees and stuff. And he'll like stop at the house and say, "Hey, can I pick these weird oranges off your tree?" And they're like, "Yeah, fine, whatever," and sell them to him or whatever his arrangement is. And so he's come back with all kinds of very oddball things. So if you're in a citrusy area, if you have access to Florida, you may be able to find, you know, find some real interesting exotics. That'd be fun to play with, fun to kind of talk about and showcase. Kumquats, fantastic. They're really rich in oils. There's a little green fruit from, it's very popular in the Philippines. It has a super like a sour orangey kind of flavor. Calamansi or calamondin. That's wonderful stuff if you can get it. If you can get access to a frozen juice type of product, those are often pretty good. Although if you use the juice, you've got to be aware of the acidity, because too much acidity kind of, to my mind, can kind of sort of fight the bitterness, certainly can mask it. And it, like, again, if you put too much acid in an IPA, it starts to not really be an IPA anymore and be kind of a bitter sour beer. Mm-hmm. So you have to be conscious of that acidity, and you may want it, you may not. Again, it depends on what you're trying to do with it.
So you mentioned the citrus works really well with an IPA. It tends to complement the flavors, I guess, but how do you get the flavor balance right when, you know, working with other fruits? What are some of the considerations of getting the overall flavor balance correct?
Yeah, this is a bigger thing. And the challenge is really a psychological challenge, because I just had on my cereal this morning, I had fresh strawberries from the farmer's market, you know, which I always really look forward to. And when you're eating one of those fresh strawberries, you're eating 100% strawberry, and you have 100% of the color, 100% of the mouthfeel, 100% of the sweetness, 100% of the acidity. If you make a beer with 100% fruit in it, you get wine. It's not beer. So the challenge is, in a normal, especially in a commercial production where you really are limited maybe to 5 or 10% of fermentables coming from fruit, coming from fruit, then you're trying to basically trick people into believing that this fruit really represents the beer, or that the beer represents the fruit, even though the fruit is just a small component of the beer. So what you normally have to do is you want to start thinking about, well, what's missing? If I'm missing 90% of my fruit, are there things that I can add back to it? Right? So sweetness is one. A lot of fruit isn't really all that sweet. Typical fruit, like a cherry or something, is maybe somewhere between 7 and 10% sugar. So it's not a huge amount of sugar. So almost you can use a little more ingredients and do a hot mash, and you'll end up with a little bit more residuals that will help.
Yeah, leave some residual body and sweetness in the beer itself, right?
Yeah, exactly. And just making the beer a little stronger, you know, because the stronger it is, the more important, the more effect you're going to have from any residuals. And also alcohol itself is a little sweet. Mm-hmm. And then, so then you want to think about there's sweetness, then there's mouthfeel, and having a kind of a creamy texture is also helpful. And that can be also done by kind of a hot mash, or maybe use some rye, which also has a little bit of a fruity characteristic. You know, rye is a pretty nice additive for beers that where you want a kind of a base level of a vague fruity thing.
I never thought of using rye as a fruit supplement.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's really, you have to just think about, you have to almost diagram it out and like, what am I missing and how can I start to supply those? And sometimes a little of this, a little of that, a little of the other thing, they have an additive effect that really can add up to something that's pretty powerful.
Now, obviously, when we ferment a fruit, it loses all of its sweetness, basically. And so, you know, I work with a lot of acidic fruits, berries, those kinds of things. And, the character of the fruit changes dramatically. The character of the flavor changes dramatically.
Yeah, in lots of different ways. I mean, first of all, you do need to ferment it, because if you don't, you're going to have blowing up bottles or overpressurized kegs or things like that, which are obviously not good in any setting. And the other thing is that a lot of fruit flavors are quite unstable. So peaches contain this chemical called gamma-decalactone. And gamma-decalactone is that beautiful, they call it the fuzzy peach smell. You know, that's that nice biting into a ripe, you know, farm-ripened peach. That classic peach flavor is this lactone chemical. And it appears to be really unstable in beer. And so you put it, no matter how much fresh peach you put in, when it goes through fermentation, that lactone, and I haven't really looked up the chemistry, but that lactone seems to more or less disappear or diminish greatly. And so strawberries are pretty much that way.
Yeah, strawberries almost disappear, at least when I've used them.
Strawberries are terrible. Yeah. And it's, strawberries are a very weird flavor, too, because it has a sort of a berry characteristic, as you'd expect. It also has like a lightly caramelized kind of a flavor that's almost like a cotton candy type of caramel, a popcorn ball type of very light caramel kind of thing, kettle corn maybe. And then it has a bit of a butyric sort of like almost like a bit of vomity kind of smell or cheesy kind of smell. And it also has a rosy, perfumey kind of smell. Mm-hmm. And it's weird because you take these four things that almost have nothing to do with each other and you put them together and then you get to a certain point and there you go, that's strawberry. And the color in strawberry is very, very, very fleeting, as are a lot of fruit colors are very sensitive to fading. And that's another thing that's really important in a fruit beer, especially a beer that has a definite color. You want to make sure that there's enough color in the beer to convince people that it's there. So you can use a small amount of something like an elderberry that's a really, really dark that will give you a bit of that pink color. Hibiscus works well, although it does fade after about 6 weeks. Hibiscus is about half as pink as it was. And also with fruit beer, you want to, with a fruit beer where you're trying to manage the color, you want to keep the malts as pale as you can to get the flavor that you want, because if it's too dark, now you've got a beer that's really yellow, because all those darker malts are basically darker and darker and darker shades of yellow. And so if you're trying to make it pink, you have to overcome the yellowness by adding more pink. And so the only you can make a pinkish amber, but if the beer is paler to start with, then the pink from the fruit or the pink that you're adding, like with hibiscus to as a colorant, you'll get more mileage out of it. So that's something to consider as well.
So which fruits are hop friendly? We're talking about doing an IPA here.
Well, again, you know, the citrus, but beyond that, I would say, you know, any of the tropicals. A passion fruit's wonderful because it's very powerful and definite in its aroma characteristics. Guava's also quite nice, although it's not that familiar flavor to a lot of Americans. Mango works really well. Those are three really great kind of tropicals. Apricot and peach work well, again, if you can manage that.
I found apricot generally does better than peach. You know, the flavor comes through almost as a peach, right?
That's been my experience. Yeah, if you want to make a peach beer, use apricots. Yeah. But so that brings up the notes, and because peaches and apricots both have this gamma decalactone chemical that seems to fade away, it's useful to employ some of those aroma top notes. You can usually get them at the homebrew store. They're just little, you know, 3 ounce bottles of a clear or maybe slightly colored kind of water thin liquid, and that contains in the best of them a distilled aroma essence from the natural products themselves. And so what those are useful for, both in commercial and homebrew settings, is not to replace the whole fruit, because they can't really reproduce the full range of flavors that you would find in a fruit. But what they're really good for is coming back in and boosting that aroma after fermentation. Mm. So, and especially with peach, you almost can't really make a very peachy beer without it. The other thing is to remember with fruit is the acidity level is different for every fruit. And in order to make a reasonable image of that fruit, like a mental image of that fruit in the beer, is that your acidity needs to be in a similar range. Now with passion fruit, for example, that's a very acid fruit. And so when you use it, it brings along all the acidity you need.
That was something I actually wanted to bring up. Acidity is really high in things like a lot of berries. You know, extreme would be like black currants, cranberries, those kinds of things. But it provides structure to the beer, and so that's one of the, you know, I have a lot of experience using a lot of these highly acidic fruits with meads, for example, because they provide structure for the mead.
How do you
balance the acidity working with something like an IPA or maybe a fragile beer?
Well, I think it's going to depend on what your beer is, because if you like, we've made a beer with pear and tarragon. We call it Paragon. And what we found was that we do a lot of little tabletop experiments with a pipetter, and we'll get the beer through fermentation, and then we'll dose it with a little bit of that aroma top note, and then we'll start looking at dosing it with some acidity to kind of bring the acidity level up to what we think is optimal for the beer. And we noticed that if you overdo the acidity on a low acid fruit, you take it completely out of its character, right? Because
pears have
a little acidity, but you're not really conscious of that acid. And so it's like, if you make a really acidic pear beer, your brain almost can't resolve the fact that it's pear because that acidity's like a huge clue that's not making sense, right? So to have everything be coherent, to have all your sensory cues be coherent and lined up with what that reality of that fruit is, that's the most important thing. And that's really the way to think about it, I believe. Be aware also that there are multiple different types of acidity that fruits have different kinds of acidity. Apple is primarily malic acid. There's a lot of that in grapes, which is why they do that malolactic fermentation where they're actually using...
used in winemaking, yeah.
Yeah, they use...
they use a separate yeast or a special yeast that eats the malic acid.
Yeah, exactly. They use the bacteria to transform that kind of edgy, rough acidity of malic acid to lactic acid. So they use lactic acid bacteria, which is why a lot of Chardonnays and even red wines have that buttery character. It comes from that lactic acid bacteria, lactobacillus fermentation, that's used as a kind of a cheat to soften those wines and make them ready for market a little quicker. But it has that buttery byproduct. You don't do that in beer. It's not really necessary to do that for that reason. But you do want to look like citric acid is super sharp with a little edge. Malic is really edgy. Lactic is super creamy and rich. You know, you might like with a fruit like peach, a little malic might be kind of like add to the creamy mouthfeel that you have that expectation for. Phosphoric acid is just super absolutely dead neutral. It's what they use in Coca-Cola. So you want to think about that. You want to think about not only the quantity of the acid, but the character of it also.
Is back sweetening or you're using lactic acid appropriate to try and get some more sweets into the beer?
Lactose.
I'm sorry. I said that wrong. You said lactic acid. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Lactose. lactose is fine. I'm not the world's biggest fan of lactose. We've used it. We've made some beers with it, and we find that it has some uses. I think when you get it to the point where it's really making the beer sweet, the sweetness has a kind of a almost to my taste a little bit of an artificial kind of character. So I find we need to be really careful about how much lactose we use. Although I will say the market seems to really really like those super sweet ones. We've got a bunch of beers right now, you know, during the pandemic, our brewer's been doing a ton of one-off kegs. And there's a company here in Chicago that's been selling a freshly squeezed juice in glass bottles for cocktail purposes. So the cocktail bars have access to like fresh watermelon juice and things like that. And he's been making these sort of milkshake IPAs and just opening the keg, dumping in a bottle or two of this, you know, whether it's watermelon or some other type of freshly squeezed fruit juice, and then recarbonating the keg and serving them, even with that unfermented juice in it. And we can get away with that. You certainly could do that as a home brewer.
You're talking about a back sweetening technique, right? You're going to stabilize the beer and then go through.
We're going to finish the beer, but we're going to just dump fruit juice in it and serve it. And so, you know, that's a situation, obviously, where you need to be in control of that keg. And
yeah, because it's going to kick off fermentation again, I would think.
It will kick off fermentation. And, you know, if it's cold, if you're serving it, you know, these are all cold kegs, you know, in our cold rooms, going through our tap lines, and they go in a few days. So we're not really worried about anything happening in there. As long as you keep it cold, it's not really going to restart that fermentation, because your yeast isn't going to get going in a new fermentation at 43 or 38 degrees or whatever the keg, whatever your cooler temperature is. So it's not really a concern, but it obviously is in packaged beer or a beer out in the market where you don't know that it might get warmed up. With the keg won't blow up from it, but it'll get overpressurized to the point where they can't serve the beer. So, those sort of milkshakes or even, what are they calling them? Like slurpy beers or something. There's a term for these beers that have a huge amount of fruit added right at the end, and you're supposed to keep them cold. But there's a lot of stories out there about blowing up cans out there. But again, in a controlled setting, if you're a homebrewer, got a keg cooler, or you want to package up some beer, bottling would be difficult because now you're actually putting yeast in and starting a fermentation. So I would not.
Yeah, you can't really bottle with a back sweetening.
Unless you're counter pressuring and then keep it cold and you should be okay. But drink it.
But yeah, you can stabilize the beer with, sulfates, sorbates, right?
You do things.
Sulfites,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Those are not things that we normally use in the professional brewing world.
Yeah. And then the key, of course, with any of these things, whether you're using, lactose or any of these other things, is balancing that acidity with the sweetness, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's just getting exactly that kind of right, that feel. You're really trying to do two things. One, you're trying to make a beer. And if it's an IPA, you're trying to make an IPA. So that has a certain boundaries. Whereas if you go beyond that too much, then it really starts to be something else, which is okay. You just call it something else. But if you're really trying to make an IPA, there's a sort of a limit to what that is. And then you're trying to reproduce that fruit character that's in there as much as you can. You're trying to integrate it with the IPA and make it kind of harmonious with what's going on in an IPA, but also make that fruit ring true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is normally with the IPAs, you're almost always seeing yellow fruit rather than red fruit.
Yeah.
Oh, and I don't know whether it's just the color or whether raspberries really don't make for an IPA.
Well, I think it goes back to that acidity thing you were talking about. I work a lot with the darker berries and so on, and they have a lot of acidity in them, which gives structure to something like a mead, but probably doesn't balance well with the hops and everything.
It can't be too much. Yeah, you just want to be conscious. Again, you know, think about that fruit as your guide. And remember that you can prototype a lot of this stuff really easily on a one beer worth basis or 200 mils or something, just a very small quantity. And I would recommend doing that if you want to play around with fruit IPAs, even as a club activity. You can bring some different IPAs and then get some passion fruit, some guava and mango, and make a citrus peel, some different citrus peel extracts by peeling them and soaking them in vodka for 24 hours or so. And whatever other kind of fruit, you can almost always get a puree or a concentrated juice or something. Mm-hmm. And just start adding and keep track of it, and then have some diluted citric acid, maybe some winemaker's acid blend, or some malic acid, some lactic acid. And you can really sit down and in an hour or so, you can work through a whole bunch of different ideas, and you can really fine tune what that beer is going to be. And that gives you a pretty good roadmap for starting to scale it up. And I, you know, in a commercial brewery, you kind of have to work that way because you can't make batch after batch after batch that's not what you want.
Right.
And so we really need to do that. Homebrewing, obviously, there's less, you know, it's just one beer, but you might as well get it the way you want it early on. And especially if you're new to it and you're just not quite sure where to go, having all that stuff, and maybe you decide that the perfect blend is mango and passion fruit, you know, or whatever, mango and apricot or whatever it happens to be, you could try combinations and with almost like zero risk and have a lot of fun, and you can learn a lot, and that will kind of show you the dynamics of how that's operating. Have a little sugar, a little lactose, just get your whole kit of possible ingredients together, and then just keep track of it. Use a little syringe or some kind of a pipette, something so that you know how much of what you're putting in. And then it's really very simple to scale that up.
Do you prefer to add the fruit in the primary or the secondary? What's your preference?
We normally add fruit towards the end of fermentation. So it's not the primary. It's, you know, we don't really, in brewing, commercial brewing, we don't really talk about a secondary. It's more of a primary and a conditioning. So we put it in when there's still yeast activity. Normally, you're checking the gravity of those beers every day or twice a day, and you'll watch the gravity chart go down and then the curve. And when it gets to that point where it's starting to flatten out, you know you still have some yeast activity. It's usually maybe day four, day five, something like that. Then we'll come in and put the fruit in then. Because if you add it too early, you're going to blow off a lot of that aroma. As Pierre Celis once said to me, yeah, otherwise it is just for the neighbors. Huh?
Well, I found you get much different character if you use it in the primary versus the secondary. It's just a matter of preference, I guess, depending on how you're using that fruit, you know.
Yeah, again, yeah. You need to build up experience with whatever it is you're doing and, you know, build your knowledge base.
But and do you use whole fruit? Do you use juices, puree? How do you prepare your fruit?
Yeah, our whole fruit is really hard to deal with in a commercial brewery unless you have some specialized equipment for it.
I would imagine.
It tends to float on the top, and my experience doing it with home brewing was that it would float on top, and you'd get mold develop on the top, which is, you know.
Effectively, you have to punch it down probably twice a day is best.
Yeah, you got to keep punching it down, and then now you're introducing more potential for contamination. So almost anything you'd want to use are available in a concentrate type of thing. If you look in the freezer, you know, like in the freezer compartment in your grocery store, or maybe you go to the supermercado or a big ethnic market, there are a lot of tropical fruits. Most of them are not really the ones you can buy in the store are not a good representation of what those fruits actually taste like, because again, they're picked early and they ripen in weird ways that doesn't allow them to be as good as if they were picked and processed in country and then turned into a puree. And so purees are great. Juices are fine, but they're a lot of juice. You know, watermelon is an interesting one, and because the flavor in watermelon is really delicate, and it resists all efforts to turn it into an extract or a concentrate or anything like that. You can buy those extracts and top notes and things, but in our experience, they've generally been kind of terrible. So we made a beer at Five Rabbit with watermelon. I think we used 4,000 pounds of watermelon. And the beer at the end was 30% watermelon juice. Wow. And that was the right amount. Because, again, it's a pretty delicate flavor. And what we found is that for the first 2-3 weeks, it was just like a first bite of a slice of watermelon, you know, right in the center of the melon. And then every week after, it became a little more cucumbery.
Oh, no.
You were eating your way to the rind. You know how it is when you eat that watermelon, you start to get the white part. And it's just like, it's, you know, if you like cucumber, it tastes fine, but it doesn't taste like watermelon anymore. And that watermelon flavor is just highly unstable. And so the only solution is just use a lot of juice and drink the beer.
I think a lot of people don't realize, but anytime you add fruit to the beer, it does dilute the beer pretty substantially, actually.
Yeah, it depends on, less with raspberries, passion fruit, things like that, because they're fairly concentrated kind of flavor.
But I mean, fruit is mostly water and sugar. So, you know, all those things disappear when you ferment it. So,
yeah. The other important thing to think about is that there are certain fruits, like I just mentioned, raspberries and passion fruit, that are very distinct and definite in their character, right? You can put one raspberry on the table in front of you. You can smell that raspberry. You know for sure what that is.
And raspberries actually survive fermentation pretty well, too. I mean, a lot of the character survives.
Yeah, that's a lactone in there also, but that one seems to be stable. Yeah. But there are also other fruits, when you eat them, they're perfectly distinctive, and you know what they are, like blackberry and blueberry. Blueberry especially has that real particular character to it, but when you take a bunch of blueberries and put it in your beer and ferment it, you just don't get that real true blueberry. You get a kind of
the interesting thing about blueberries is almost all the flavor comes from the skin. When you actually taste the blueberry, the center of it doesn't have like an explosion of flavor or anything. A lot of it's the tannins in the skin that you're tasting. Yeah. And so mentioned, when you ferment it, it really doesn't come through all that well.
And when they're making juice out of it or concentrate, they're not really getting that skin. You know, they're pressing the juice out and they're ready to go. It's like you take red grapes and just press them, you get white wine, more or less, or blush. So you just need to be aware of what the character of that fruit is. And with blueberries, I don't know, you're kind of there. I don't know if there's really good solutions. There may be some top notes where they have tried to adjust the ratio of that uniquely blueberry kind of character Certainly, if you can get wild blueberries, those have a little more aromatic punch.
Almost need like a pile of blueberry skins or something like that. You know, like they sell grape skins.
But. Yeah, exactly. But you may want to, like, you know, I don't know what you would. You'd almost need a crusher to crush those out, crush those down, because if you put whole fruit in, it's very difficult to really extract stuff out of them. You almost need to crush them, tear them up so that they're exposed. So that would, you know. You could build something, I suppose, but it sounds like...
Well, Randy, we're actually coming up near the end of our time here, but I wanted to ask, do you have any closing thoughts on fruit beer, fruity IPAs?
No, not really. Just, you know, follow the fruit and, be true to the style, but follow the fruit and let the fruit tell you what it wants, you know, because everybody, you know, everybody listening to the show knows exactly what a strawberry or a blueberry or a cherry tastes like. And, you know, you just like to have that illusion to really get that fruit to kind of pop into your mind. It takes a number of different sensory cues to make that happen. So follow that and, you should be good.
Well, Randy, again, I appreciate you coming back on the show. Always great to have you here.
Always great to be here, Brad. Love talking about beer.
And again, my guest today was Randy Mosher. He's the author of Mastering Homebrew, Radical Brewing, and Tasting Beer, as well as a partner in the Chicago breweries, Five Rabbit and Forbidden Root. Thank you again, Randy. Great to have you.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. I appreciate it.
A big thank you to Randy Mosher for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a digital brewhouse controller with high precision and flexibility. The Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and advanced brew day settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander from Blickman Engineering. To order yours today, go to blickmanengineering.com. Again, that's blickmanengineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. I've just released the Beersmith 3.1 desktop update, which includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash hop pH models, and a whole lot more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. I thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.